captives, and some of your volunteers. Appreciate your presence, nevertheless. If you were at our session on Tuesday, when we were discussing metrical psalmody, you will recall that we suggested that for our Baptist churches, for a thought in seeking a restitution of psalm singing in whatever ways may be available to our churches, that we follow the principle of renovation of the psalmody of Isaac Watts, the principle of bringing up to date and making relevant the singing of the psalms, even for the 20th century, even as he did for the man and woman in the pew of the 18th century. I feel that a further logical conclusion for our day in following out Isaac Watts' tenet, that we must consider seriously the phenomenon of modern translations of the scriptures and of their setting in music of contemporary idiom. Few people, I believe, today would dispute any longer the need for new translations of the Bible to make the Word of God meaningful and significant to modern man. We have all welcomed the fresh force by which the Word can break in anew to speak relevantly to contemporary life by means of these new versions. By the same token, there must be an openness to innovation with regard to the musical settings of the Bible for our common worship. In various areas of the Christian world, experimentation with several contemporary idioms are now being carried on. Mr. Davidson just brought me in some psalms that the 20th Century Light Music Group is experimenting with in England. There are other groups, there are folk groups in this country that are dealing with the psalms and setting it to music that relates to their kind of taste and background. But possibly the style that has commanded the most attention and has been of most widespread use in recent years is that of the French musician and clergyman by the name of Joseph Jelinek. If we will recall metrical psalmody again for a moment, I think that this is a very interesting instance of history repeating itself. Just as it was through the French verse of Clément Marot and the French music of Louis Bourgeois that the metrical psalm got its start and became so useful to our Puritan forefathers, so today it is through the French translation of the Jerusalem Bible and the musical inventiveness of a contemporary Frenchman, Jelinek, that we are offered a new way of singing the psalms. Now, I wish to file a disclaimer right at the very outset here as to having any great knowledge or experience with this psalmody at all. I have no authority by which I could stand here and expound on this subject. There are some here who, I am sure, have had more experience and know more about it than I do. And I want to go on record as saying I'm just sort of leading the discussion, and I would like for it to be completely open. And if Phil Malpas, who has had experience with this, and certainly Sister Rosalie, have suggestions to make and comments, we would welcome them as we go along. But first of all, it might be interesting to have just a few facts as to the origin of this psalmody. It seems when the new French translation of the Jerusalem Bible was being prepared, the translators decided to do something quite new in their treatment of the Psalms. First of all, they were intent upon an exact reproduction of the meaning of the Hebrew. Now, this is not necessarily new. I suppose every translator who's come along has sought to be very faithful to the meaning of the original. But in the second place, they were going to make it obvious how the verse of the Hebrew was constructed, not like the usual Bible printing in short prose sections, but as varied in structure as any modern book of poetry. According to whatever the original was, the stanzas might consist of 3, 4, 5, even 8 lines. But most important, they were intent upon the feat of producing the exact Hebrew rhythm of the Psalms. At first, on the surface, this might seem to be quite difficult, if not impossible. And yet, in actual fact, it's not so difficult at all, because the Hebrew rhythm of psalmody is basically a very simple one, as Dr. Francisco explained to us on Tuesday. If I understand it briefly, to review it, it is this. Instead of having a fixed number of syllables in a given line, there is a fixed number of stressed syllables. And then a certain variety is allowable in the total number of syllables to be found each line. Now, it so happens that this kind of stress rhythm is very native to English. In fact, it was the basis of early English verse, as we shall see momentarily. Now, when the French translators were doing their work, Jelinek conceived an idea. Whether it was entirely original with him is not known. But he thought of a way by which the Psalms might be made known and sung in this new translation. He evolved a method whereby the structural rhythmic principle of the Hebrew Psalter, as reproduced in the French translation, could be employed in a musical way. He first produced 24 selected psalms and a canticle that very soon became very well received and well known in France, widely diffused. It spread like wildfire. Meanwhile, there were a group of people in England who spotted this phenomenon and decided it would possibly be of great advantage if these translations could be made available to English-speaking congregations. Accordingly, they obtained permission from Jelinek to make an English translation. They secured a panel of Hebrew scholars, and following the very same technical principle as in the case of the French, following the basic rhythmic principle of the Hebrew, they made their English translations. Subsequently, another edition came out of 30 more of the Psalms. And the final step, of course, was the American printing of these two collections of Psalms by the Gregorian Institute of America. The collection we're looking at is the second one that, and the most recent one that has been published in this country. Now, as indicated before, this rhythmic principle is very simple, inasmuch as there's always a fixed number of stresses per line. As Francisco told us, it's more a rhythm of ideas attached to important words in the Hebrew than it is a rhythm of syllables in meter. The same principle occurs frequently in English folk songs, in English nursery rhymes, and even in more serious rhythmic compositions, such as early English verse. I'm greatly indebted for some of this commentary to Dom Gregory Murray, who has prepared a little syllabus or instruction book on how to perform these. And I take no credit for any of this information. This kind of rhythm, of course, is referred to as sprung rhythm. Its underlying system, that of a series of evenly spaced stresses, usually three or four to a line, with a free intersprinkling of non-stressed syllables. Now, a simple example of the instinctive way in which we resort to this kind of rhythm in our popular verse is afforded by the nursery rhyme Three Blind Mice. This jingle is based on the principle of three stresses, three important stresses per line. And yet, there may be any number of syllables per line, even as many as 11. Let's look at it. We all know it, don't we? Three blind mice, three blind mice. See how they run. Four syllables, but only three stresses. See how they run. They all ran after the farmer's wife. Nine syllables, three stresses. She cut off their tails with a carving knife. 10 syllables. Did ever you see such a sight in your life? 11 syllables, as three blind mice. Three stressed syllables, but see what a great variety of total number of syllables. If you were to reduce that little round to metrical meters, as you can find it in the music, you would find, of course, that it fits very nicely into a four-beat pattern, with each stress having a more or less ternary division We would call it 12:8. Now, as we said, this is the technique in early Semitic poetry, as Dr. Francisco told us, including the Psalms. However, Semitic poetry, while it has these stresses, is not anything like, is much more sophisticated than, of course, Three Blind Mice. I think we can see this now if we will immediately go to one of these Psalms and just speak in rhythm the word, the text, as we see it. Let's turn to page 32. The Psalm 112, Praise, O Servants of the Lord. This is the Laudate Pueri from the Vesper service of Monteverdi. That's the Psalm 113 that was sung in metrical version yesterday in chapel. Here we have it in the Gelinol version. We will not be concerned about the music yet. It's the text and its rhythm we want to notice first. Each line of verse contains a fixed number of stressed syllables falling at a strictly measured pace, placed equidistantly one from the other. And the intervening syllables, or the unstressed syllables, are spoken quite freely in natural speech rhythm. Let's speak the first verse. This goes all the way down to the last score. Praise, O servants of the Lord. Praise the name of the Lord. May the name of the Lord be blessed, both now and forevermore. From the rising of the sun to its setting, praise be the name of the Lord. You see, the stress is quite obvious there. Although the stress syllables have exactly the same role as in the nursery rhyme, Three Blind Mice, the intervening syllables do not, because you don't have just three, but you may have two, you may have one, you may have none. And yet the pace is inexorable. To render this smoothly, then, is where the fun begins, when you come to setting it to the music. I'd like to speak just another word about this English text, and then we will go to the music. There have been scores of translations of the Psalms, but few of them that were designed specifically for singing. Some have been, even those that have not been so careful to preserve the Hebrew form, as seems to be the case here. You will note that these texts of the Gelinol setting, if you glance through here, avoid the archaic forms of most present-day vernacular prayers. The familiar forms of Elizabethan address, thee and thou, have been completely discarded. We're not here judging as to the whether this is good or bad, but this is simply the case here. Also, you will note that there is no attempt to create rhyming verse endings. There is no rhyme, as in the old metrical psalms, which in any case is not characteristic of Hebrew poetry. Anyway, this characteristic, along with the use of sprung rhythm, made possible a more literal translation of the texts, but at the same time, a more musical translation. Because of the natural richness of the English language. You see, it gives the translator any number of phrases that he may convey a Hebrew line with. According to Dom Gregory Murray, who has been a collaborator in the preparation of the English language edition here, and who has composed a number of the antiphons, which you can tell by his initials, AGM, inscribed at the conclusion of each of them. He did not write the antiphon for this one we're looking at, but if you look at the next page, Psalm 123, he is the composer of the antiphon there. He has claimed that the choice of English words were made with an awareness of the singability of the line and the articulation that may be expected from any average group of singers. You see, English, by virtue of having been enriched in its vocabulary by every language that it touched, has such a remarkable versatility and adaptability that it can almost fit any kind of rhythmic scheme. A given thought can either be compressed to one word or two, or it can be expanded through a whole line of several syllables. And in this respect, as Gelinol and others observed, English is really more suited to rendering the Hebrew line for line than is French, for which the original Gelinol settings were devised. In fact, when Gelinol was approached about the translation into English, He predicted that the English translators would have a lot easier time of it than the French translators, because the English language takes much more kindly to this kind of stress and accentuation, and because, of course, this same rhythmic principle is deeply embedded in its very language. Now let's look at the melodies and the manner of performing them. Since for most choirs and other groups, the singing of this psalmody will be a new experience, a certain amount of background and rehearsal, of course, would be inevitable. I think you will find that if you try these with your choir, the handling of the intervening syllables will present the greatest rehearsal requirement. They can all feel the beat, but where do you place these intermediary syllables as you go along? This will very likely be the occasion of some problems in performance. Natural speech patterns is the goal, of course, for these unstressed syllables. But everyone seems to feel the spacing and the patterns of these syllables not exactly in the same way many times. So the director, whoever is leading, is going to have to make some decisions, albeit arbitrary maybe, in order to have unanimity. In performance, the pulse is one slow beat to the bar. It's suggested, as you probably have read in the foreword, that the metronome barking would be somewhere between 48 and 72. 48, to me, seems awfully slow. Yet you hear some recordings that almost approach this. I would incline much nearer to the 72 pulsation. But this makes, of course, the individual syllables clip along at a pretty good pace. And because of this relatively quick flow of the text, the intervening syllables only rarely number more than three, never more than four. Now let's look at this Psalm 112 and just look at a few instances of how this might be performed. Three intervening syllables almost invariably form a four-syllable unit if you take into account the stressed syllable. Notice the first verse here. Praise, O servants of the Lord, servants of the Lord. The most easy and natural division there would be something approximating four quarter notes. Not rigidly necessarily, but this probably is the easiest intervening pattern to perform. Look at the second stanza. Beginning of the second stanza, you have it in both of the first two measures. High above all nations is the Lord. Ta 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 ta. If you keep the accentuation, of course. Now, two intervening syllables combined with the preceding stress to form a great variety of units. Perhaps the most common is a binary grouping, in which the stress takes half the bar and the two unstressed syllables the remainder. Look at the third verse. From the dust he lifts. Now, this could be either performed the dust as a, let's say, a dotted half and he as a quarter. In other words, it would be a short duration to he, or it could be performed as two halves. It would depend upon the nature of the syllable that was there. Now, fairly often, however, the three-syllable pattern can assume a broad triplet form. For instance, in the first verse, praise, O servants of the Lord, praise the name of the Lord. Now you can say, name of the Lord. That'd be half note and two quarters. But personally, for my taste, I would like a triplet. Name of the Lord. That seems to have a better flavor and style of line preserved there. It may be just a matter of taste, but the suggestion in the literature is that it could be either way. Look at the doxology, for instance, at the bottom. If you're going to do it binary, give praise to the Father Almighty. It begins to get sing-song, it seems to me. To the Son, Jesus Christ, the Lord. Well, I think Jesus needs more room than that. To his Son, Jesus Christ, the Lord. seems to me that here is one of the keys to a natural and unstilted performance of the Psalms. One of the great dangers is that of reducing everything to binary rhythm and thus introducing a secondary stress in the middle of every bar. And we have been warned against this in the literature. Now, if there's only one intermediary syllable falling between two stresses, two forms are commonly found to fit most cases. One divides the bar evenly, allowing the intermediary syllables a long value, while the other treats it short, depending on the nature of the word or as to how short it would be. First verse, phrase one, praise O. Does O get a lot of duration? There's some more chairs over here if you want to come and have a seat, even in the front. Or if you want O to be short. It seems to me that sometimes the pattern that has been established in the preceding bar may determine what the division may be when you have only one interceding syllable. For instance, in the example at the end of verse 1 here, from the rising of the sun to its setting, praised be the name of the Lord, or to his son Jesus Christ the Lord. This is a better one. In the fourth stanza first, give praise to the Father Almighty, to his son Jesus Christ the Lord. I feel that both of those are ternary. In other words, it's not Christ the Lord, but Christ the Lord, dividing into three, because of what happened before. Son Jesus Christ the Lord. Well, I don't know. I'm just going by instinct. Then, of course, four intermediary syllables, adding to the preceding stressed syllable, form a five-syllable unit, and this causes a problem. Look over at Psalm 136 for just a moment. You see, five equal notes are not so natural to most singers. Divide equally five. The syllables will fall, therefore, possibly in performance, into non-symmetrical groupings around one or more secondary stresses. After all, everything in English can be resolved into groupings of three or two, as those of you who know Gregorian chant and Anglican chant would testify. Look in the third stanza of this particular one. If I forget you, Jerusalem, let my. Five syllables intervening. Jerusalem, let my right hand wither. Well, I think Jerusalem would have to be a triplet, and then let my would take the rest of it. But you're going to have to be pretty flexible there, and this is perhaps the most difficult grouping to render smoothly, since it comes so seldom and it comes so suddenly. But you have to be ready for it. Considerable practice would be necessary in order adequately to anticipate it and to perform it naturally. There are, as you of course have noticed, many instances when there are no intervening syllables, as in the first psalm again that we were looking at, back at page 38, I believe. No, 32, thank you. In the very first stanza, praise, O ye servants of the Lord, rest, praise the name of the Lord. And of course, you simply wait. The pulsation goes on, and you wait for the next stressed syllable. But after all is said and done, I would draw your attention to the last section of the introductory note on further points. Look at the introductory note and the very last section and be warned hereby. In general, it should be remembered that these psalms are to be freely declaimed rather than merely sung. Provided, therefore, that the tempo of the one beat in the bar is strictly maintained, the introductory and intervening syllables should be sung with the free rhythm of correct speech, not measured out strictly in musical note values. The musical note values may be helpful in the learning process, but then you have to throw them out and go upon natural flow of correct speech. Now, with regard to the performance with the melody, it should be noted that each stressed syllable usually has a single tone. Mr. Pugh is going to help us now Would you just simply play the principal notes here, just showing the outline of this very simple folk-like melody that we have here? Just play the principal notes without rhythm. Just pom, pom, pom. Simple, and all of the intervening syllables are sung in this particular instance upon the pitch of the stressed syllable. Praise, O servants of the Lord, praise the name of the Lord. There are a few exceptions to this, and I will simply call attention to it right now before we start singing it. Look at 136 again, page 38. You notice here in the end of the first score some intervening syllables which are not the same as the stressed. These simple anacrusis are melodic movements in which the intervening syllables are fitted, so that this would have to come more or less as is familiar in Anglican chant. At the designated time, you have to have a little melodic turn there. But that is very, very exceptional. We will be singing that one in a minute. Now, let's all sing. Maybe the male chorale, being our authorities here, can demonstrate the first stanza, and then we'll all get in the act. There, of course, are introductory syllables, and therefore, to accommodate this, the accompaniment must give the stress before we start. All right, we'll just sing the first stanza, gentlemen, without the antiphon, in unison, if you do not mind. 112, first stanza, in unison, without the antiphon.
Praise, O servants of the Lord.
Absolutely regular pulse coinciding with these accented syllables, and the pace is absolutely rigidly regular throughout. A word now about the harmony before we go to singing the harmony. The music, as you can see, is melodically extremely simple in design. In fact, almost folk-like in its simplicity, some modal feeling here. The harmonies supplied with them are basic, they are repetitive, and also somewhat modal. I say somewhat because the modes of the music are not strictly related to any given theory of medieval music, as are the church modes. The scale lines in the melody may be those of what we popularly call church modes. But the harmonies are not. In fact, there's a contemporary ring to these harmonies, added sixths, other dissonances are used, even polytonal chords may be heard. All liberties consistent with harmonic idioms of our own times. Furthermore, the harmonizations of these tones, which cadence on the third of the traditional major, are treated in such a manner as to suggest that the final note is the harmonic home. And this, of course, is an idea which is opposed to the prevailing theory in harmonizing a medieval Latin chant. To those of you who are familiar with the Gregorian psalm tones, there is a familiar ring, possibly, many of these. We are told that some of these, indeed, are almost identical in tonal sequence to some of the psalm tones in the Epiphanale. But the rhythmic organization is quite different. owing to this application of sprung rhythm. There are even certain tones which bear no resemblance at all to any used currently in the Western Church. For example, the oriental color of that "By the Rivers of Babylon" that we'll be singing in a minute is drawn actually from Byzantine tradition and not from the West at all. The use of the antiphons also, I'll mention before we go on, is a very ancient practice in the singing of the Psalms. These refrains, which may be introduced at the beginning or at the end or in between in a very flexible fashion, point up variable but always appropriate meanings. Some of them are obligatory. If you look at Psalm 80 on page 24, you will see that there's an indication that it is obligatory before verse 1. If you look on page 25, Psalm 83, you have an antiphon 1, which must be sung before verse 1 because it's part of the text of the psalm. And then at the bottom, antiphon 2 must be sung after verse 7. However, in most cases, they're not obligatory, and therefore a great amount of flexibility may be used in performance. The most important principle to keep in mind is that the tempo of the antiphon be identical with that of the psalm, so that the one beat in the bar of the psalm equals the beat unit of the antiphon, whatever that may be. It may be a quarter note, as in 3/4 time, and it might be a dotted quarter, as in 6/8 time. We're going to have the male chorale demonstrate that now, if we could. Let's all sing Psalm 112 again, since we've become familiar with it. And after the first stanza, gentlemen, will you sing the antiphon in harmony? Notice that that this particular antiphon has a little bit of counterpoint in it and makes it quite interesting. Then after we have sung the antiphon, let's all be ready to go back to verse 2. It's in this transition from verse to antiphon that likely some problems are encountered because of having to keep the flow, because of the natural retard that you feel at the end, and then have to set the pace again with that inexorable beat. All right, here we go. You understand how we're going to do it? Verse 1, antiphon by the male chorale, verse 2, then maybe antiphon 2 if we have time. All right.
Praise, O servants of the Lord, praise the name of the Lord, may the name of the Lord be blessed, both now and forevermore, from the rising of the sun to its setting, praising the name of the Lord.
We have to have the introductory chord. Now, on some of the recordings, this is left out. And I guess this may be subject to difference of opinion. But after the antiphon, even though there are no syllables, introductory syllables, the accompanying instrument plays the chord before starting again. Of course, you would have to have the chord for starting number 3. In order to get in your introductions. All right, let's take the antiphon again. You see the problems that are encountered here. Chapel, and maybe we can join in also. Dr. Lynn, would you like to come and sing for us your Psalm 124. This is page 35. Now, these, of course, there's a great variety of performance. They can be performed in unison. Some of them have to be performed in unison. They're indicated as such. But many times they may be performed in parts. They may be sung in unison in the verses and the antiphon performed in parts. They may be sung responsorially, antiphonally, or direct in any of the three ways that the ancient's harmony was performed. Now, I think the chorale is singing this one in unison and the antiphon in harmony. Is that right? You begin with the antiphon, which, of course, is the way that it's usually in the practice. All right. Another phenomenon here, that is, because of the irregularity of the length of the verses in certain psalms, certain of the musical phrases are omitted, cuts required in the music for the shorter psalm verses. And so the performers must be prepared for this and skip over the bracketed spaces to the next word without losing the beat or the natural flow of the words. As you see, we still need a lot of practice in this. And it, although we can understand the principle real quickly to get it smoothly, and to get it to flow and to get the intermediary syllables together will require a considerable amount of practice. Now, will the chorale also show us how we could sing in harmony? The 150th Psalm, page 44. Now, when singing in harmony, this can be accompanied or unaccompanied. The top voice carrying the melody can be the one taking the words, and the others can simply be humming. Or they can all sing the words, in which case there would be the accompanying instrument. You notice that Mr. Pugh is playing, where appropriate, these introductory syllables, the little upbeats, and this is suggested also. Only when it is there is the accompanist to play, and of course he has to be alert to do that. All right, sir.
I'm going to sing the first two stanzas, then going to the antiphon, and the third four minutes.
Praise him with all that was.
us all, and let's do a couple of stanzas then with the antiphon. Do the first two stanzas with the antiphon. Let's all get the feel of this and encounter existentially the problems of these intervening syllables. You see the important need to keep, according to this system, to keep the pulse going in moving from the antiphon to the verse, or from the verse to the antiphon, and keeping that time beat the same as the pulsation of the psalm. Now, it is possible to use various kinds of accompanying instruments with this. The piano is here, the organ, as we are will hear in chapel in just a few minutes. I understand Sister Rosalie told me that I'm sure there's differences of opinion, even among the Catholics, as I'm sure there is among you here, as to the value of this. And those who probably don't like it so much call it the jelly roll psalms. This could be performed to guitar. And I have a little recording here of Cy Grant. Maybe you've heard it. Cy Grant, a folk singer with a group in England, playing, I believe it's Psalm 32. What page would that be in here? Page 12. Just a part of Psalm 32, but he uses the antiphon that we just sang together, with the antiphon to Psalm 150, which again shows you some of the flexibility in use that is possible here. You'll recognize our familiar tune that we have encountered now for the third time. But notice the accompaniment, and notice how the choir does here in that the introductory chord is given by the choir on the antiphon rather than by the instrument. We'll start this one now.
Give thanks to the Lord upon the harp, for the ten strings who sing him songs, or sing him songs.
Ten strings, that binary.
Play loudly
the division. It almost gets sing-songy, it seems to me. Text.
He frustrates the designs of the nation. He defeats the plans of the people. His own design to stand forever.
Now here's the antiphon on page 44.
Yes,
although you could hardly, unless you had a large auto harp, could hardly keep to these harmonies as indicated here. However, I know this of some, and by the way, there are tune additions. This is a tune addition which could be given to a singing group, choir, if you were not singing in harmony. And there are some who simply take this and with their auto harp just harmonize it, you know, according to our folk tradition, and seems to go pretty well, especially with young people. Then you can also do this with woodwinds. In fact, if you turn to page 38, the one we were referring to a while ago, you will notice that this is suggested to be sung in unison or as a solo. The accompaniment for either the organ are woodwinds, indicated here as oboe, clarinet, and second clarinet or bassoon. Dr. Landgrave has brought along three clarinets this morning, and we want to see what we can do with this one, maybe. This is the one which has the problem of a five syllable unit in it. This is also the one that does not follow any Western medieval mode, but actually, as I understand it, is the second mode of the Byzantine theory. And possibly the nature of the text here has dictated Gelinot's use of this particular mode. Now you're going to see how I will have problems, but I'm going to try to sing it with these gentlemen's help. Mr. Johnson, Mr. Darrell, and Dr. Landgrave, we thank you for your participation here. The way we will do it, and the male chorale will be ready to sing the antiphon. The antiphon will be hummed in the three lower voices, and only the upper line will be sung. We will sing one verse, and then antiphon, and then we will sing two verses, I hope, and then conclude with antiphon. Decide for yourself and in the light of your own situation as to whether this type of music is feasible at all or whether you yourself can relate to it at all. But we must be open to the consideration of the possibilities. That's the main point to be made here today. I know of certain situations where this would be quite appropriate. I know of young people especially who are wild about this. It may have possibilities for choral use in some churches. In others, it's not inconceivable that congregations could sing some of the simpler ones, after some training, to be sure. One thing I do know, in this fast-changing age, we must be ready to innovate, to change our methods and approaches, to experiment. Let's take a good look at John O'Somerly. Let's take a good look at any other kind of psalm singing that may come along. If we reject it, let's reject it not on the basis of ignorance, but on the basis of having looked at it and decided for ourselves whether we can use it. Not for the sake of innovation, not for the sake of change, but for the sake of restoring this great body of devotional literature, the Psalter, to a meaningful place in our public worship. I wonder if there are any questions or any comments. Yes.
I have a question, please, sir, about the text and translation from the Hebrew. I recall that you said that they threw out the these and thous from the Hebrew period. Is this the King James English basically?
No. This is modern. This is modern translation, of course. You mean the Jellinol?
What I was saying, that was why I said to the Rocky Ridge Baptist Church back in Birmingham, we want to use God's word and we want to come back to the Psalms and let the water of life flow through our veins and our hearts again by singing God's word. And I tell my preacher, this is good old Bible, and if I can keep hide the word Gregorian from the people so they won't get all shook up. That's what I've been telling them too. They will go ahead and use this material, but it's certainly refreshing, to say the least.
How would you answer? I'm not sure that I know the thrust of your question, but certainly you can't pull the wool over people's eyes. They're going to have to know generally what this is, but they must know the reason behind it. It was Martin Luther and others who said, why let the devil have all the good tunes? And this is exactly the same principle as Calvin followed with regard to the metrical psalm. He took the popular tunes of the day and used them. Now some people are offended by this, and of course the whole business of the dichotomy between secular and sacred comes in here for discussion. Of course, you have the problem of the translation. Some people do not think that it's the Bible unless it's the old black Bible, not these red Bibles, or not this New Testament and modern English, or whatever it is. And you'll constantly have this problem. Yes.
Has anyone here had experience of experimenting with these in a church situation?
Anybody answer this? I have the only experience I've had is singing in the Jewish temple with them, without the doxology.
Just in case people feel you have to buy a $3 book, they are available in cards.
Thank you for mentioning that.
One on each side.
Thank you for mentioning that. What you have bought is, of course, the accompanist edition, which has all the harmonies. But you can use it either in these small editions or even in the cards if you want, just to use a few. And much more to you. Thank you, Doctor. Any other comments or questions? Sister, do you have anything to enlighten us on this? We sang it poorly, didn't we?
We sang you. I have been in our own territory.
Thank you. We're so glad you're with us.
Are these the antiphons that are traditionally associated with these psalms in the offices or in the propers of the Hebrew liturgies?
Some of them, I understand, are, and of course there was flexibility
there. There is some
the text, yes, but there is flexibility. In fact, you will find with one and the same psalm, another feast day, another service, a different antiphon is used with the same psalm, as I understand it, sometimes.
Do you just choose when to use the antiphon, this, how you want to structure it, whether to respond to every stanza or...
Depends on maybe how much time you have.
Or
you can even lengthen it out.
Isn't it the fact that the antiphon used to be sung between every stanza?
That's
every
verse,
therefore.
The derivation of the term. It started it, and it was between everyone, and it stopped it.
A good way is to use it before and after.
And you can frame the entire psalm, however you understand the song before that.
We choose our anthem dependent upon when we sing the psalm. If we sing the psalm at communion time, we might use one anthem. If we sing it at the opening of the service, we would use a different anthem. Also, dependent on the feast of the day, we choose our anthem. So that is one way of choosing.
So in our use, of course, the principal flexibility is there, and therefore we could extend that. I think we are going to hear some of these now upstairs in just a few minutes. We have some orders of worship for those of you who want to hold.